Hi, I'm Ashley Nichols.
And I'm Shamara Arkey.
And I am Casey Boyd Swan.
We're podcasting from Northeast Ohio. This is the Growing Democracy Podcast, a space to amplify multiple forms of knowledge, demystify politics, policy, and governance, and foster equity-centered civic engagement.
Each episode, we invite a guest or two to talk about what it means to be civically engaged, how engagement can be leveraged to dismantle systems of oppression, and how to grow a socially just and equitable democracy.
Welcome to the show, and thanks for joining us.
Excellent. I am super excited today to have with us Christy Belli. Christy, you are the co-director of ESDRE. Could you tell me a little bit about your role at Kent State and what ESDRE is?
Absolutely. So I am an assistant professor, almost associate professor of biology. Next contract year, they gave me tenure. But I recently started a partial admin position, co-directing the Environmental Science and Design Research Institute. And so this is one of Kent State's several interdisciplinary research institutes. And so our jobs are to bring together researchers from all over campus and have them working together in meaningful, sustained ways. And our area is environmental science and design. So built environments, conservation, even things like biomimicry. So taking things from the natural world and using them to design products. My work is actually in computational ecology. So I build models to describe systems. So this is sort of a natural connection for me. But this year we had a really amazing symposium. We have symposia every year where we bring together people on a theme. And we had a symposium themed environmental justice and race. Environmental justice, ecology, and race. So this is what we're going to be talking a little bit about today.
That's awesome. So this is a kind of a special issue of our podcast. Christy, is that okay if I call you Christy in this context?
Absolutely. Yes.
Excellent. So Christy and I collaborated on co-hosting this episode, in part because we were both on the ESDRE symposium working committee, me in the capacity of being a member and an affiliate faculty, and Christy being one of the co-organizers. When we were thinking about how the work of this symposium, environmental justice, ecology, and race, would unfold, one of the things that came up was the possibility of the two of us co-hosting a podcast for the Growing Democracy podcast, in part because there's so many different ways in which kind of this idea of environmental justice, the ideas of ecology and kind of the intersections of race fit in with our conceptions of civic and political engagement, conversations around democratic governance and public policy. And so I was really excited that we were able to make this work. But one of the things I do want to mention really quickly and ask Christy to comment on is that you also host a podcast. So would you momentarily give a shout out to your podcast?
Absolutely. So I am the co-host with two other researchers here at Kent State of How Do You Know, a podcast where we discuss the ideas and the people behind the numbers. So I am a data scientist and number nerd, and I got really interested in how people were shaping numbers because science really likes to think it's something separate from people.
Lives out there in the future.
Yeah. And then, well, my job was analyzing data produced by people and having lots of questions about it. And, you know, usually like things and parts of controlled studies and looking at their methods and going, well, but why did you make this decision? Why did you approach this way? And I kind of became radicalized by data science, realizing that sometimes the numbers aren't the whole story. And so this podcast is about that. And so my colleagues, Bridget Mulvey, who's an education specialist, and Rebecca Cato, who's a sociologist, we all get together and we talk to absolutely amazing people to talk about what's behind their numbers.
Love it. Well, and I mean, it fits, you know, and part of the reason that we collaborated is that this episode also fits and overlaps a bit with some of the work that y'all are doing on that podcast as well. So I, you know, want to ask my last question to you before we kind of pivot and bring in our guest is to talk a little bit about the symposium and the keynote and, you know, how Dr. Dracita Taylor came to, you know, be such a presence at our symposium this year. And, you know, how you see her work intersecting race, democracy, and kind of fitting in with the theme of the symposium. That was a stumbly way of getting that out.
Yeah, well, so Dr. Dracita Taylor is an absolute thought leader when it comes to conservation movements in America. So she actually literally wrote the book, America.
Yes.
Oh, I'm going to stumble on it because I don't have it, but the Rise of the American Conservation Movement, I think is the name of it. She has had multiple positions in very prominent institutions where she has really laid the groundwork for how we think about conservation, ecology, and race. She was one of the first names that came up in the discussions when we were talking about building this symposium, because she has done some really incredible work looking at how inequalities play out in the conservation movement. So there's so many facets of conservation that ultimately exclude people. So there are aspects of conservation that are really very NIMBY-ish. So, keeping environments in particular ways, particular aesthetics for the dominant culture. So you have white, predominantly European descended people who have particular aesthetics, ideas about wildness, and these ideas about how wilderness in North America is separate from people. And that is obviously not true. There were people here when European settlers arrived. And so these ideas are really opposed to what actually happened in the history of the space and the current ongoing dynamics of the space. So Dr. Taylor has really explored a lot of these issues. She's also explored a lot on contemporary conservation issues. And so she gets into this a little bit in our interview, but how the people who are doing conservation right now are essentially who has access to conservation organizations, who has access, who is making the decisions within the conservation organizations. And so she has some really interesting things and a lot of hard data to show on this.
Absolutely. So thank you for guest hosting with me, Christy. I really appreciate it. It's been really fun. And I'm really excited to welcome in our guest for this episode, Dr. Dracita Taylor.
So I'll start us off by just welcoming you, Dr. Taylor. I really appreciate you being here. As a momentary fangirl, I'm going to say that I assign your books in many of my classes. So very excited to be talking with you across the table. But to get us started, I want to, you know, hear from you about, you know, how you came to do what you do.
Yes, good question. I always think of myself as kind of being born to do environmental work, biology, zoology, botany. And I started becoming very interested in the environment when I was about 5-6 years old. I grew up in Jamaica, rural Jamaica, and you're looking at a young girl in the 60s, and so you're often tasked with housework. But housework also meant the gardens, because I grew up in on a property that had just beautiful rose bushes and a lot of flowers. And to this day, I'm always still very interested in the flowers, etc. So while I was out in those gardens, I just started to really pay attention to the butterflies, the bees, the little critters that were coming by, but just the beauty of the flowers. And that kind of lifelong interest in being outdoors just really continued through my teenage years into my adult life, where I was, that curiosity just sparked this broader interest in understanding how do some places have all of that beauty and other places don't, if we look at those kind of two separate pieces. But that's kind of my natural comfort zone. Even today in, you know, my house in Hamden, Connecticut, I was, you know, having a conversation with a red fox that hangs out in the backyard and the deer with the, you know, the two baby, the fawns that come around. But they, I swear, must have about a million birds that inhabit the backyard and the way they're building their nests at this time and just the flowers. The people who owned the property before me laid out the most amazing flower garden. And I'm just kind of in nirvana at this time of the year because everything comes out in sequence, and I just really pay attention to that. And that stimulates my work, my thought, how much work I get done if I have that kind of beautiful space around me.
That's amazing.
I love that waking up time in spring where you're like, oh, that's there, right. I remember this. It's coming and this is coming. Oh, that's my favorite thing.
Yeah.
So you talked a bit about how you were drawn to a lot of nature and STEM as a young girl. But how did your early experiences in STEM shape your movement into this interdisciplinary space that you're working in now?
Right. So I started off in the Caribbean. You are trained under the British system. You take the same exams that are taken at Oxford and Cambridge to get out of high school. You simply don't get a diploma in the Caribbean by going to high school for 4 or 5 years. Nobody grants you a diploma for that. You have to pass what's called the O levels, ordinary level exams, and the A levels, the advanced level exams. And to do this, you specialize very early. Not only do you specialize, you have to be science, or literature, English, and I don't even think there's an option 3. So you're either STEM, not STEM. We didn't call it STEM. And so coming out of that background where I grew up with a lot of people my skin color, we're black, we're Asian, Indian, and black, or we're all kinds of brown and black kids, and we excel in the sciences. We excel in biology, zoology, chemistry, and physics. So it wasn't until I migrated to the U.S. at age 20 and started to do, I was in an environmental studies class, learning very interesting things. And I looked around the room, and for the first time realized I was the only person of color in the room. And this was my first experience now of flipping the switch, where when you looked around you in the sciences, you didn't see anybody else that looked like you. And so I kind of asked the professor, where are all the other black students? This is such a cool class, I thought. Why weren't there other black students learning this stuff? And he promptly said, blacks are not interested in the environment. And I thought to myself, idiot. I didn't. Luckily, luckily, my caustic tongue didn't, you know, mouth the words, but that's what I was thinking in my head. And in typical kind of, you know, pseudo-arrogant Caribbean style, marched myself off to the library to prove him wrong. But every piece of literature I picked up in the scholarly literature said exactly what he said. And so this was a disconnect with my first 20 years where I didn't know a world in which brown and black people didn't do environment, didn't excel at it, didn't do the sciences. We all did. We all excelled at it. So what he said to me did not jive with my experience. And so immediately I thought, what is it with these Americans that can think an entire race of people don't do environment? So had I not had that experience before, I probably could have been like other students like myself, brown and black, who are told that and believe it because they don't have an alternate worldview to compare it with. So a couple of things. There I understood the value of having different life experiences where I could, in my mind, 100% said, you are wrong. And I know you're wrong because I've lived something else. But secondly, I'm going to do something about it. So like literally my first study that I did was my undergraduate, we didn't call it a thesis, but it really was a thesis, where I went around campus and I interviewed students on campus to find out about their environmental attitudes and to show that the students of color that were in my sample had interest in the environment, they wanted to do it, they wanted to study it. It wasn't that they weren't interested. There were other factors that were at play. And that question I asked Professor, his response, and then my response to his response completely changed my career. Because prior to that, I was the zoologist that was going to go into genetic engineering and create some kind of super grain or something to help reduce famine in Africa. This was the 80s, the African famine, and this drying out of Africa was just coming onto the radar screen, and that was where I was headed. All of that went out the window with this one question, one comment, and now I start to change trajectory to think, I need to understand more about how social science works and how people think and how do we come up with these logics. And then I need to explore them more and to come up with a body of knowledge that really counteracts this, what I can still consider to be this absurd notion that because you're black or because you're brown, you don't know about the environment, you're not interested, you don't care, you're not concerned. And that logic still exists today. I've researched that I put out in 2021 that when you ask the head of environmental organizations, what are they doing about equity, diversity in their organizations, or how do they think about their staff and their staff diversity, they forget they're answering a survey, and the truth comes out somewhere around page 15 of the survey, where they really will say, we don't have people of color, or we don't have blacks. Blacks are the favorite whipping horse. We don't have blacks in our environment, in our organization. We can't find them. They don't apply for jobs. They're not interested. They don't know about the environment. If we hire them, they won't stay. So this issue of if you're black, you lack the knowledge is still very prominent, even today, and even someone like myself with more degrees than I can count in the field still get labeled and targeted with that kind of perception. It so goes. But yes, it's interesting how one question and one response can completely change your trajectory.
Absolutely. Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to ask. I come out of the social sciences, mm-hmm. And, you know, in my classes, we talk a little bit about the history of environmental justice emerging both as a movement and as scholarship. And a lot of the EJ movement and scholarship are rooted and informed by grassroots activism, organizing in Black, Indigenous, and other people of color. How do you see your work informing the current environmental justice movement?
Yeah, good question. So with the emergence of environmental justice, it's interesting that it also emerged out of scholarship, because when I was a student at Yale in the 80s, as I transitioned now from going to heavy science and STEM to actually pursuing a sociology degree, I pursued both at the same time, I realized that there was this whole body of knowledge that could be brought to the table that I didn't have, that I wanted to focus on. But I spent an awful lot of time convincing professors that there was something going on that we eventually labeled about 8 years later as environmental justice. And in 1990, for instance, professors at the University of Michigan called together a meeting, and there were literally only 20 of us in the room. And we literally sat there for 4 days trying to say, can we identify everybody in the country, either who's doing grassroots work, policy work, EPA, Forest Service, Park Service, or academic work? And at that time, several of us were African-American scholars. So myself, Robert Bullard, Beverly Wright, you know, we were people in the room, and it was some of our early research that helped put in context that broader thing that we saw going on. By 1991, when we had the first People of Color Summit in Washington, D.C., that was kind of the moment when hundreds of us were at that meeting, and community activists could say, for the first time, they could see that what was going on in their community wasn't an individual event. It wasn't a solo event. It was there was a pattern to what we saw. So many people, when they look at environmental justice history, they start with Warren County, 1983, and say this is the beginning. That really isn't particularly true. You saw these, you know, I can go back to 1793 in Philadelphia, for instance, and you see the emergence of things that today we would call it environmental justice, but there was no label back then. So both pieces go together. Where I see my role always has been in a space that produced some of that knowledge, because I realize one of the niches that was needed to expand the environmental justice movement and do it rapidly was a niche for someone who can translate. You can hear an activist in a meeting say something, and you can help to facilitate that translation by putting together either a document or the proof or the evidence for that activist and that policymaker to speak to each other. You can put together the curriculum to train the next generation and the next generation. I have so many of my students who are founders of EJ organizations. They start it. They are working in the policy arena. So you need to produce those people also. It's not just you do a protest. You need to have, you know, the data. And back in the 90s, that was one of the pieces that the activists kept talking about. They would go to the EPA. The EPA would call the police on them and, you know, arrest them or disperse the protest. What they were saying, they just didn't have the numbers and the evidence to back it up. And so we needed to, if we say the toxic donut in the south side of Chicago, it's causing a lot of cancers. The policymaker says, how do you know this? Mm-hmm. What's your evidence? And the activists, they needed to figure out how to be trained to collect that door-to-door survey. They need to understand how to document all the illnesses on their blocks, you know, to do the spatial analysis. And those were the pieces they were missing. And so someone like myself, you play a very key role in helping with those things. One example, contemporary, you ask for, just about 3 weeks ago, because I simply cannot help myself from from stirring the pot, no matter how old I get, you know, the devil just wakes me up and say, Dorcita, go and do X. So what did Dorcita do about 3 weeks ago? Unload a document that looks at funding. So, you know, we can talk about environmental justice from the perspective of toxics, of polluting a community, but we can also look at funding. Mm-hmm. Are the activists that are doing social justice, racial justice, environmental justice, climate justice work, are they being funded to the level that they need to be funding to be effective at what they do? And the report that I just did, my students and I, we studied 3 years of environmental grant-making data. Now, who does that? But I decided we were going to look at grant-making data and ask the question, how much money, first of all, is being given out? So $4.9 billion, as in a B, dollars. That's a lot of money. And that's just for 3 years of funding. Who gets it? And what our research showed, and this is the first time anyone has documented the numbers to this extent, is that, for instance, the Sierra Club, so one environmental organization, gets five times as much funding as 85 environmental justice organizations that I studied. And no one, we suspected or we knew at an organic level that if you're an environmental justice organization, you don't get as much money as National Wildlife, Audubon, Sierra Club, etc.
Right.
We know that, and people have complained about that, activists have complained about that. Until about 3 weeks ago, they did not have the data to show that it wasn't that you don't get as much. It is one organization getting five times as much as 85 organizations. And so that report has just exploded. So it's not just that. If you take two or three organizations that say they're doing environmental justice work, if the organization is led by a white person, they get more funding than if it's led by a person of color. If the organizations are led by women, they get less funding than if they're led by men. And no one had documented something that, again, you suspect. And this is where academics can really play a key role. Yeah. We suspect it. We say it. Mm-hmm. Until you have the data to march into the foundations to say, here is the data. We downloaded your grants, so we're not making this up. This is your grants, your analysis. So this study really showed some of those huge disparities. If an organization says it's working on racial justice, it gets less funding than if it isn't. Mm-hmm. So even with white organizations, if they're working on EJ versus if they're not, they get more money than if they say they're working on environmental justice. So those kinds of things just really are exciting to me. Once I release, and I didn't publish this as a research article. I started off thinking I was going to do that, but I thought, release it into the public space, release it into the grassroots, also release it to the foundations so they can atone for their bad behavior. So it's working at both angles, this kind of translator role that apparently when I just literally uploaded it to the web and created free access for everybody to download. Apparently a lot of foundations downloaded it and was like, oh my Lord, getting very nervous also. Because I ranked them.
Oh, yeah.
I ranked them because they love rankings.
Yes.
So I ranked them in terms of who was giving money, but also for the organizations to really see. I was getting letters from, you know, activists on Native reservations saying, we've long suspected this, but we have never been able to figure out how to, for instance, if you're talking to a foundation and they're telling you, I'd like to give you $20,000, are you really going to sit there and say to them, but you give X number, you say thank you for the $20,000 and try to do $500,000 worth of work with $20,000. Yeah. Now, for the first time, you can show them their ranking.
Yeah, show them
you can show them the numbers, and you can, but you also now know that you should be asking for more money.
Yeah.
And you now have a logic for saying, here is the work we want to do. It's around climate, it's around equity, it's around justice. We cannot get it done on $50,000 or $100,000. If you give the Sierra Club $10 million or $20 million, so the total Sierra Club over 3 years, for instance, and they were the number one, so I remember theirs, $213 million of grants alone in 3 years.
Wow.
Whereas 85 environmental justice organization total $43
million. Oh, wow.
So the scales are so uneven. And even though it was a tremendous amount of work to collect that data, because yes, you can download from a foundation website the overarching numbers, but you literally have to go to, it's 30,000 grants that we looked at, 30,248. You have to go each of those grant by grant by grant to then look up all the rest of the information. So it's time consuming. It's the sort of stuff where a typical environmental organization does not have the capacity or the staff to do that work. That's where academic institutions, student activists, faculty like myself, that's where we can have a niche and a really big impact by taking on that part of the work.
Mm-hmm.
So you might not necessarily need me at the protest, but you will need me to provide the ammunition you need to walk in and now start to ask for the money and demand the money with justification to do the work you need to do to help the climate. Yeah. So I'm not saying don't fund the Sierra Club or the Audubon or the National Wildlife Society or Nature Conservancy or Conservation International. I'm not saying don't fund them. What I am saying is you have to fund these other groups,
right.
And you have to understand your biases.
Yeah.
Your racial bias, your gender bias, your topic bias. We haven't even talked about region. The other thing I was able to document was, if you're in the South, and if you anybody who does environment and environmental justice knows that some of your biggest problems are in that South, deep South area, they get the least funding.
Mm-hmm.
So your funding is not matching up.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest funding goes to San Francisco and New York.
Yeah. It reminds me of your first comment, actually, around this assumption that your faculty member had that there are no Black people interested in the sciences.
Right.
Well, foundations are perpetuating this idea that these smaller scale environmental justice organizations don't have capacity. Well, you're not.
Right.
They don't have the funding
capacity.
To build capacity.
Right. Yeah. Yes, right.
It's like
a chicken and an egg question.
It's reinforcing.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, especially if you look at it, if you even ask the question, what logic is there to give more money to an organization simply because it's run by a man?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons I do the gender analysis and the race analysis and then do the intersectional race and gender, it's precisely to get at this piece. And when I explored the gender piece, I really actually didn't expect to find a significant difference. I really didn't, because I thought we're in 2023, right? Women have proven that we can do environment. We founded the organizations. Most EJ organizations are headed by women. A lot of environmental organizations, once you get out of the top 20, a lot, probably a higher percentage of them are headed by women. Where are we still coming up with this bias? We haven't even talked about income. But as you can predict from where this is going, other studies I've done still show a huge gender bias in salary in environmental organizations. And so these are things that I found myself over time starting to look at these things, because the way my mind works, it tells me, I bet you there's something going on here. Why hasn't anybody else studied this?
Mm-hmm.
And either I am crazy, and if I am, I'd like to prove myself wrong. But if I'm not, and what I'm seeing, because as you talk to people casually, you start to see these differences. I wonder if I can find the data to show it. And so very critical role, I think, for young people who are listening, activists who are listening, people who are leading organizations, is to actually do some of these studies in your own organizations yourselves, mm-hmm. so that we have so much information that we can really stamp out these biases, the foundations that clearly are operating with a bias. And until 3 weeks ago, no one called out. And that report literally got downloaded more than 10,000 times in about 2.5 weeks. So, it really showed that there's a demand for this kind of work. I haven't checked it in about a week, but it surprised me how it was just flying off, literally flying off the shelf. Places like LinkedIn was very critical, because after I posted it on my ResearchGate site, I put it on my LinkedIn and my Twitter. And it just went, because I'm not a Facebook person. I'm not big on social media, but as I tell my children, I use social media not to find out what people are doing at the grocery store or what is going on. I really don't care, even if they're my friends or stuff. I don't need to know what you're doing every second. But if for research or this sort of stuff, they're really very helpful tools. And that's how I use social media, not in, here's a selfie of me.
Yeah, they're really great for connecting with a broader network of people that you don't necessarily get through your institution or your local community, I find.
And it's their networks, because what happened on LinkedIn was it hit LinkedIn, and within literally half an hour, it was put into another network group that I wasn't a part of, but that network had 300 people that then sent it on and sent it on, and everyone was downloading, and even the smallest EJ organization got a hold of it within a day or two of it coming out. The same thing at the top end, that the foundations all got a hold of it, they were sending it on, and then the nonprofit environmental complex also got a hold of it. So kind of interesting ways in which people can think about how do you do work in the movement, and there's so many ways to do it.
It sounds really fascinating, and I can't actually wait to read this report, because it wasn't on my radar yet.
I can send it to you guys.
Yeah, I'm delighted.
And you can put it out in your circle, right?
I have worked with a bunch of environmental organizations through my work, so I'm an environmental scientist and data scientist mostly, and so there are patterns.
There are.
Especially within the larger organizations. So, so curious.
No, I'll send it to you, because the way it was done also is heavy graphics. Mm-hmm. So big tables, big charts, so that you didn't have to worry about reading everything there. Because if you're an activist, you do not have time. The report is almost 200 pages long. But you can see the charts.
So data scientist fan moment of just thinking of the incredibly different ways of people reporting things and then bringing that synthesis together. That is a huge amount of work.
Huge. Yeah.
So I have another question, if it's okay, if I jump in. So it's my understanding that you do a little bit of work in food security as well.
A lot of work.
So it's a little bit of a pivot. Mm-hmm. So how do you see environmental justice and food security as intersected?
Yeah, I'm doing right now quite extensive projects on that. So we have been studying about 12 different cities in Michigan. And when I moved out to Connecticut, I thought if I'm going to be in New England, I should add some New England cities. So we're studying. So in addition to cities like Detroit, Flint, Grand Rapids, Saginaw, et cetera, in Michigan, we're looking at cities like Boston, Springfield, Holyoke, Chicopee, Massachusetts, Providence, Rhode Island, coming to Connecticut and looking at New Haven, Bridgeport, and West Haven. So all, and then in my lab, because students in my lab, they have their own ideas, and I have a student from Atlanta. What about Atlanta? Well, you go and, you know, we'll download the data, and you go and collect and bring Atlanta in. So what about Salt Lake City? So we're also doing Salt Lake City. So very interesting. It's playing a big role because when you look at cities, for instance, say Detroit, you can't talk about health, and especially children's health, without looking at food and access to food. And you can't even do that without looking at infrastructure. So Detroit is a city that has been literally gutted from the inside, where it's a huge city, people don't realize. It's about, you know, it's about two or three times the size of Boston, big city in terms of just space. It's a city also that was built for the automobile. So the public transit part of the city has always been very weak because it was designed for you to drive around it. However, if you look at the city, a lot of the destruction of property and where you have a lot of vacant property is in the core of the city. And the intact part of the city is on the outskirts. So very interesting. But it's a place now where there's this very vibrant urban farming community. There's a lot of vacant property. Mm-hmm. Actually, studies show that Detroit could come very close to feeding itself if a lot of that vacant land was converted to farm and agriculture. So there are groups like D-Town Farm in the city that's operating, and you can grow about 10 and a half, 11 months of the year with good greenhouses and stuff like that. So you can grow a fair bit of food. So with our access studies, we're looking at what communities have access to what kinds of stores. The pandemic came along, and so we switched gears as we were studying to look at how many stores were closing down. So we literally last fall came up with one of the earliest studies that's studying an entire city, the city of Flint, to look at how many stores got closed during the pandemic and where those closures are. So what was already a very fragile food infrastructure inside the city, especially in the poorest Black communities, is now turning into almost what we call a hollowed out or vanishing food infrastructure, where all those stores closed. Mm-hmm. The local restaurants closed. So people now have to go to the outside of the city to be able to purchase food. And I think we're seeing that in Detroit. We're seeing that in some of the cities we're studying in New England. So that looking at access to food, looking at urban agriculture, how much of it there is in the cities, looking at things like one of the phenomena that we saw during COVID, it wasn't just the delivery services. So something like Walmart, talk about Walmart. Walmart understood this, and they immediately, in places like Flint, started to do home deliveries, and they didn't charge you a delivery charge. So they were getting home deliveries in, and they've continued it post-pandemic. Mm-hmm. So very low-income people that were not getting groceries delivered. They used to have to go to the grocery store. The pandemic has changed that. Mm-hmm. Now food comes to you. So if we're looking at food now, we have to really start understanding that it's not just do you drive or walk to the store. You have to look at the e-commerce part of it. But the other thing we saw during the pandemic was the rise in mobile food distribution. So we saw more veggie vans, more food trucks going into neighborhoods, but even with emergency food delivery. So soup kitchens, pantries also became mobile. Some of those have closed down post-pandemic, but those are just new dimensions to understanding food and food access that we're seeing. Still strong overlap between poverty and lack of certain kinds of food stores and outlets. Like, you know, your Whole Foods does not set up in the poor neighborhoods, neither does your Trader Joe's. And so the question becomes, when do those outlets become affordable? and can they set up in neighborhoods successfully. Whole Foods did set up a store in Detroit, even though it's very close to the very poor part of the Black community. It sits right beside Wayne State Medical School, mm-hmm. so all your doctors, mm-hmm. It's literally beside the parking lot. And it's across the street from where University of Michigan has its Detroit kind of center, but it also sits right where the very wealthy white suburbs, and you come off the bridge to come into Detroit, that it sits right on the main pathway. So they know where their clientele are. And they've been in that location for several years now, and they've done quite well in that location. And it's a downsized Whole Foods, so it's not the massive Whole Foods that you find if you go to Ann Arbor 40 miles away.
Right.
Their pricing is also a little bit different, because I've had my students go to the different Whole Foods and check on the different prices in them. We've been doing a lot of really interesting work. We're looking at, for instance, immigrant communities. So one of my students, she did her master's thesis on looking at Latinx immigrants and how they access food. And what are the challenges that are arising? And she did it in Massachusetts and Florida. So Florida also one of the places we study. And things like immigration services. They literally show up to food pantries, soup kitchens, and other places that distribute food to just show up and arrest people.
Wow.
So when you look at it from an environmental justice perspective, you're hungry, you have no food in your house, you have no money to buy food, but because of the policing mm-hmm. of food donation and food giveaway spaces, you don't go there or you're afraid to go there. So it's causing greater hunger and harm in communities. And it wasn't until my student really started going to these centers, and you could see the police presence, unbelievable, and ICE. ICE is just literally sitting there. That this is a piece you don't normally think of if you're thinking food and how do we get food to people. You don't think ICE and immigration.
Right.
Yeah.
But when you're in Miami and it's a Latinx community, that's a choice people have to make. Do you starve? Let your children starve, or do you run the risk of being picked up by ICE because you go into one of these drive-through spaces? Yes, we're seeing it all the time. We're seeing more and more environmental justice organizations and activists and groups really pick up on the food piece of it. So that shift, people are still looking at toxics, they're still looking at hazardous wastes, etc., but they're realizing you need to also be thinking about food justice as a piece of it. And so, yeah, we're seeing that.
All right. Wow. So do you have any final words of wisdom for scholars and activists interested in affecting change through their research?
Mm-hmm. I would say do research that's useful. Yes, you need your research to advance in your career, but don't just think of that piece. Even as a younger person, think about how it can help. And if you think of the larger picture, environment, we need to protect the environment. We need to care for it. We need to care for people in the environment. And if you think along those lines, then you really, there's just so much more work to be done. There is no shortage of very excellent kind of work that can be done with students, work with communities. Many students have hubris and they think they know the answer, and they think people are, just because someone doesn't go to college doesn't mean they can't school you. With their knowledge and their understanding, there are different ways of learning. And so I'd say to students, be very humble. And when you approach communities from a space of humility. When I work with communities like Detroit, et cetera, I walk in and I'm, Dorcita or Sister Dorcita, and that community oftentimes doesn't know that from my research grant, I poured in $100,000 a year into their organization to do some of their work, because I don't enter the community and say who I am and I gave you X, or I send you students. It's just me sitting in a corner listening. And quite often they have no idea of the connection between myself and what they're doing or the work. So if especially younger students just understand that if you're talking to people in Cleveland or Detroit or Chicago, their situation might be one of poverty, but it's not because they're doing something wrong necessarily, or it's not because they don't know any better or they can't fix it. There are other institutional pieces. So understand the institutions, understand how the pieces fit together, and then just really be willing to help and be humble. And, you know, you don't need to take a selfie for everything you do. And stop there.
Well, I'm honored to have shared space with you. Thank you so much for being with us and being in conversation.
Yeah. Thank you. It was wonderful talking with you, and I'm enjoying my time here. Thanks.
Yes, thank you so much for coming. We're so excited to have you for this broader symposium, too.
Absolutely. Yes. No, it's been a great event so far. Thank you.
Okay. All right. So...
Thanks for listening to the Growing Democracy podcast. Our podcast is edited by Jeremy Demery at Golden Ox Studio right here in Cleveland, Ohio. This podcast is supported by the Center for Pan-African Culture and the School of Peace and Conflict Studies at Kent State University, with additional support from Mark Lewine and the John Gray Painter Program. If you like our show and want to know more, check out our website, growingdemocracyoh.org. If you want to support the podcast, as well as get access to behind-the-scenes content, live chat, and swag featuring designs by Donuts and Coffee, head over to patreon.com/growingdemocracyoh. Join us next time when we continue this conversation around growing democracy.